You're listening to the Thoroughbred Post on the Equisport Radio Network. Brought to you by Ballyrose, your full-service South Florida farm and bloodstock agency. And now from Ballyrose Farm, here's our host Les Saltzman.
A little ungenerously, but as often is the case, leads the way. Out by a couple of lengths to Rondua, within a length and a half now. In third placing, Allegorical. Mannix finding a seam up the inside. Duke of Love, the center. Splitting horses is Fuerte Ventura. Getting back now, Unraptured. A nice setup for Luck Makaza, who's a length away last of all. Out in front is Ironstone. They run along towards the three and a half. In front by a length to Rondua. Allegorical the outside. Mannix the rail from Duke of Love. Called upon in the center, making ground. Then Fuerte Ventura. Luck Makaza starting to run up the inside from the back. And off the track is Unraptured. Rondua racing to Ironstone. Rondua in front has grabbed Ironstone. And as they turn in, the Marine coming home is Mannix. Got held up on the inside quite badly. Duke of Love's flashing home down the center. Rondua taken on by Duke of Love. Duke of Love trying to balance up, has the head on the side, but Rondua's raced away. Rondua grinding clear of the opposition in a massive win. Rondua stamps himself as a big threat in the Queen's Plate. Rondua canters in, wins the Marine five lengths and could have won by 10. Second Duke of Love, third Ironstone, and then came Mannix. And on the outside, the rest were headed by Allegorical.
Katerina, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And first of all, let's just talk about that race for a couple of seconds and the horse, Rondor, who I guess his half-brother won yesterday. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. He won a maiden special weight first time out yesterday. We were very pleased with that.
Now, the Rondor story is kind of an interesting one, in the fact that he was a buyback for $6,000.
What happened there is the owners, they're also the breeders, and they had run him through the sale to get him sort of nominated for some sales stakes that we have here at Woodbine in Canada. So if you have a horse that runs through that sale, you then can run in the sales stakes in their two-year-old year. So they never put the horse through the sale with the intention to actually sell him. They just wanted to get him nominated for those stakes.
Well, that was a pretty clever move, and he's turned out to be quite the horse for you.
Yes, he's quite a special horse. I'm very fortunate to have him in the barn, and his brother as well.
Now, let's, if we can, talk a little bit about you and how you, because you have taken probably one of the least conventional paths to the racetrack than anybody I know, and I've been doing this a long time. You moved to Canada when you were how old?
7 years old, in 1989.
Okay. And you came from Russia, from St. Petersburg, and you moved to Canada. And from the little that I've read, it seems like you had a pretty traditional road to university.
Yes, that's right. I have Eastern European parents. You know, education means a lot in our family. There was nobody with any sort of horse background in our family, but I always loved them as a little girl. So to appease my parents, I did the whole school thing. I went through the paces and got my university degrees. I did enjoy what I studied, but the horses were always sort of on the sideline for me. They were what I really had a passion for. They were what I really enjoyed. So I wandered onto the racetrack one summer when I was looking to earn some tuition money for university. I knew some people who worked at the racetrack from the show horse world, which I dabbled in a little bit when I was younger. And I knew that if you knew a thing or two about horses, you could probably get a job there pretty easily. And so that's how I ended up on the racetrack. And I just sort of, I caught the bug instantly, and I wanted to learn all of the ins and outs of the business. So I started hot walking and grooming, and then I wanted to learn how to gallop race horses, and then I became an assistant, and then eventually that led me to get my trainer's license.
But one of the interesting things that I found when I started looking into your situation is a lot of people that go through the motions of going to college they take, you know, basket weaving or like myself, sociology, you know, real easy courses. You didn't quite do that. You took
You
actually had a study.
I was planning to be a forensic scientist. That was my plan. And I actually did enjoy, like I said, I enjoyed what I studied. So I took biology and forensic science, and the goal was for me to work in a crime lab eventually and analyze DNA evidence. So I was on my path to do that. But like I said, the horses were always sort of nagging me to get back into that world. And I half-heartedly tried to get a job in the field I was studying for. And when that didn't work out, I wasn't super disappointed because I said, okay, well, there's my sign to try and make something out of the racetrack.
Now, you know, you obviously have a scientific mind. And
yeah, I think so. Very analytical. I think that helps with the horses.
That was the question I was going to ask you. I think especially these days, the ability to take a step back and look at your horse and figure things out really, really helps.
Yeah, everybody always asks me, do you think all that education you got was a waste? And no, I really don't think it was, even though I'm not using, you know, exactly the information I learned about. I'm not using genetics and biology and forensic science at work every day, per se. But what postgraduate education taught me to do was to think critically, to persevere when there were challenges, things like that, just how to overcome problems. And we have problems and challenges daily with in the horse world with the different horses that we come across.
I think the thought process has become so important that you have to look at your horse and analyze not only the condition book, but the condition of the horse. And
yeah,
with that kind of background, I think you have a great basis for that.
Yeah, it sure helps, like I said. And also, you know, dealing with veterinarians by having a biology background, I can understand more about the anatomy of the horse, how medications work, how you know, injuries happen, things like that. So I definitely think my education helped me now as a trainer.
Now, you said you were an assistant trainer and then you went out on your own.
Yes.
And how did you attract owners? Because again, you know, nobody in the family has been in the business and you're a relatively young person when you start. How did you attract owners?
Well, my very first owner had horses with my boss at the time, which was Mike Pino. So he was willing to give me a couple of horses to train. And I also had one of my own horses. So I started with a 3-horse barn and sort of went from there.
So I imagine you walked them, you groomed them, you did everything. Mm-hmm.
I did it all, yes, in the beginning. I rode them, I groomed them, and I did everything. And I quite enjoyed that because I felt like, you know, if they ran well, I had something to do with the whole process. And that was really satisfying.
For a young trainer, I know from my own personal experience when I got started, it was so important for me to be able to put my hands on each of my horses every day. Because not only did I, you know, I learned from them, but I also learned them. And I knew what was their sensitivities and how I could possibly improve them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes that gets forgotten in today's world.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's something that I still very much pride myself on, is being a very hands-on trainer. I still have a relatively compact barn compared to some, you know, usually about a 20-horse barn. And I do really enjoy knowing all my horses intimately. They're all individuals. They all have, you know, certain needs, likes, dislikes, quirks, idiosyncrasies. And I think that's what gives a smaller barn like me a little bit of an edge sometimes, is that I might know my horses a little bit better than somebody with a bigger barn.
No,
so
you
I
know,
definitely enjoy that.
Just in reading a little bit about you and watching you over the last couple of years, I think you're probably kind of old school in that regard. You know, and I would think that you probably go down the shed row and see this one hasn't eaten as well as he did 3 days ago and wonder why.
Right, exactly. I guess you could call me that. I try to be open-minded to, you know, just different things, new or old school, as you might call them. But exactly. The main thing I like to focus on is what does that horse need? That particular horse right there, you know, how does it like to train? You know, is anything uncomfortable or hurting it? How could I make it happier? How could I make it more comfortable? And I think happy horses run. At the end of the day, if you can make them happy and comfortable, they'll give you everything they have on the racetrack.
No, I agree with that. And I think that's the right strategy with any horse, whether it's racing or in any of the fields. If you can keep them comfortable and happy and feeling confident, you're going to get a lot more out of them. Now,
right.
With 20, you're still working really hard. Matter of fact, that's a tough number, right? That's a kind of an in-between number where you're really involved with your horses, but you need help. And I understand.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I don't do it all myself anymore.
No,
But I understand. I have a really great team of employees that I'm really thankful to have, and we've been having a very good year, so I'm very fortunate.
Your horses are running well, and I read somewhere you have some folks over from Eastern Europe helping you out right now. Is that correct?
Oh, well, he's gone back to school, but it's my my nephew, yep, from Ukraine. Him and his family came to Canada in April when the war was escalating in Ukraine. And I took him to the barn with me one day. Again, he had no horse background, just like I didn't. And he caught the bug as well. he loved everything about it. And he went with me to work several times a week and helped out. And he caught on really quickly, actually, and became quite helpful. So that worked out really well for the summer. And now he's back at school, but he tries to come with me whenever he can get a little break on the weekend.
Great, great. So you've created another barn rat.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Another horse nut.
Now, do you have kids?
Yes, I have a 5-year-old son.
And I'm sure you've taken him to the barn.
He's come with me to the barn, but he doesn't really seem to have an interest for the horses per se. He'll enjoy feeding them mints or carrots for a few minutes, but he's a typical boy. He'd rather go play in the dirt pile or he'd chase the pigeons down the shed or something like that.
I can relate. I have two sons and they're obviously much bigger.
There you go.
I used to take them to the barn and they still have Kanga Rockaroos, those little rocking things. And, you know, I put them in the tack room and I'd be, you know, and to this day, and I was training up north in Philadelphia, to this day, they don't forgive me for making them freeze as babies.
made them tougher.
I don't know about that, but it's making me tougher hearing them complain about it. But tell me a little bit about your plans. Are you going to come back down to Florida for the winter? Or?
Yes, I've applied for stalls at Palmetto's Training Center, and I plan to take a handful of horses there. I have one nice Florida bred that I'm looking forward to running down there, Roaring Forties. He's won 2 allowance races here at Woodbine so far, and I think I'm looking forward to running him in some of the state bred races there. And, of course, Rondor, you know, we'll get him ready for the woodbine season while we're down there, and probably run him as well in Florida.
And now that we have younger horses, we have Dolly here now, too.
Yes. So lots of options. The weather is nice, and I'm hoping for a good winter.
Well, we hope to see you when you're down here and invite you out to the farm. It's been great speaking with you, and continued good luck. And one last question. Tell me about some of your owners, because you seem to have some folks that really are locked into your way of business.
Well, Borders Racing Stable is my biggest owner now, and they're the owners of Rondor and Gem Quality and Roaring Forties, who I just mentioned. They have about 7 or 8 horses with me. And I was lucky enough to have them in my stable through Danny Vella. He's a colleague of mine here at Woodbine. He was looking to downsize his stable. Excuse me. And he recommended that they find a new trainer. And he gave them several names on a list, and thankfully my name was on that list, and they went with me. And, you know, it's been a really good partnership. They're tremendous people that let me do my job, and they're very kind. They have very nice horses that I get to work with, and I'm very, very fortunate to have them in my stable.
Great. And do you have any of your own still?
I do not. I have a...
That's why you're so happy.
I have a yearling. Not right now racing. I have a yearling that will be racing next year.
Okay, great. We'll keep an eye out for it. Again, thank you for joining us. We'll see you when you're down here, and continued good luck.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Take care. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And if you'll stay with us, folks, we're going to have Peter Berry, who is the track announcer at Mountaineer Park, a very, very interesting guy. So we're just going to take a brief break, and we will be right back.
The finest care for your horses in a quite relaxed natural environment. That's what you will get at Bally Rose Farm in South Florida. Customized feed, therapy, and turnout programs ensure that every horse gets the attention they need and deserve. With more than 35 years of professional experience, the Bally Rose team works hard for you and your horses and is known for its client communications. Turnouts, breeding stock, or layup, Bally Rose is your best choice. Visit ballyrose.com or call 561-774-5200.
And now back to the show. Here's Les.
And we're back with Peter Berry. Peter, how are you?
I'm really good, Les. How are you?
Excellent, thanks. And thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, no worries. Looking forward to it.
So there you are in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And I detect a very strong Brooklyn accent.
Yeah. You've nailed it.
You know, I've got an ear. Peter, you're from Australia originally.
Yes. I am from Australia, but, you know, I've just done some calculations, and I've actually lived in this country longer, which is strange. A lot of people lose their accent very quickly, and I think that I've been, lucky to keep it, but I think the reason that I have is that I speak to Michael Rohner a lot, and my mother lives not too far from me, so I'm getting, you know, there's still a lot of Australian accent in my life, and I'm, you know, listen to a lot of Australian radio and watch all the races from Australia as best I can. So, but even still, you'd think that it would have lessened a lot, but I don't think it has. I go back and listen to some radio shows I did in when I moved out here, and it just sounds the same as now. So I think I've hung on to it pretty well.
I have to tell you, the first time I heard you at Mountaineer, it caught me off guard.
Oh, okay. What did I do?
Well, no, you know, because I'm older, and so I remember Mountaineer when it was Waterford.
Right.
Okay. And in those days, anybody that can make it up to the press box was the track announcer.
Well, you know, so I took over from Jim Dolan, who was there for 19 years, and this is my 19th year. So I just have the one more year, and then I become the longest tenured race caller at Mountaineer, so I've got to stay for that, right?
Absolutely.
But he was there for 19 years, but he's called, he was the track announcer at Yonkers for a long time. I didn't know it. I went back and I was doing some research on some horses, and I'm listening to the call and I'm like, wait a minute, that's Jim Dolan. So he's been around here, there and everywhere pretty much. But I was very surprised to know that he was the track announcer at Yonkers. But yeah, as
that
I say,
is surprising.
He was. Sorry?
That is surprising.
Yeah, and how long ago would it have been? Maybe about 8 or 10 years ago. I couldn't make it in one day. Something happened. I don't remember. But they brought Jim back to call for one night, and he would have been in his late 80s at that time, yeah. I think. He's still alive. Best I know. he must be getting up towards the century mark. Jim told me a great story one time, I'll never forget it. He was being interviewed by a local newspaper in the area here, and the reporter asked him, how do you remember all the horses? You know, how do you tell them all apart? And he said that he would go to the stable of a morning and see who was running, and he would look at their face. He'd memorize their faces of the horses. And sure enough, it was printed in the paper that that's how we could tell the horses apart, by their faces. And so I've told that story a few times just, you know, for the fun of it. And I've been putting myself, saying that that's how I do it, but not too many people believe it. But this reporter believed it, and the editors at the newspaper thought it was okay, and away it went. That was about 25 years ago, I believe.
Now, so you've been, you know, it's amazing to me how time flies, because the fact that you've been there that long, it just seems like the first time we used to race there, the first time I heard you, we were racing, and again, it doesn't seem that long. It's great. One of the things that I have noticed, though, Peter, is you are probably the biggest proponent of racing at Mountaineer of anybody. You're really proud of that racetrack.
Yes, when I started there in 2004. It was right when the casino had opened and there was plenty of money around. We were getting some very nice horses at that time. Fabulous Strike came in a few times before he won the Sprinter Eclipse. And the purses were really good. We had some high-class stakes racing throughout the year, not just on West Virginia Derby Day. And so for the first half dozen years or so, it was fantastic, absolutely fantastic. It didn't take much to promote the place because everything was great. I think I'm under my fourth set of owners now. And, of course, the way racing is, it's, you know, the fields aren't what they used to be. We get a lot of criticism because we're off the turf a lot. Well, we can't help the rain. And, you know, a lot of times the track will be just so close to us being able to race on it, the turf course, but that might be just a little bit soft in one spot. And especially now with the HISA rules, there's extra vetting, I guess you could call it, on track conditions and when you should run and when we shouldn't. We cancelled Wednesday? Yeah, last Wednesday we cancelled early because the forecast, there was lightning forecast. And so Heiser said, you know, you can't run. And so we didn't. We cancelled probably about 3 hours before post. But as far as promoting the track, you know, I'm on Twitter and Facebook, and it's just kind of evolved into that. You know, as I've got to know the owners and the trainers and the jockeys and other people, I've just enjoyed learning and being able to write some stories. And they're not stories. I mean, they're pretty much just capsules with the space allowed, especially on Twitter. And Facebook, I tend to roll along a little bit. What I try and do is post 3 or 4 times during the night with what's happening, you know, some type of results and backstories and that type of thing. And the jockeys and the trainers are very good at letting me know if they've got a milestone coming up. I like to recognise the assistants and the grooms of the winner of each race. So I've got owners and trainers contacting me quite often to let me know, this person left the stable and now I've got this person working. I've got a big list of all the trainers and the grooms, and I like to give them a mention because they're such a vital part. But yeah, it's just, I think it's like a tsunami I've promoted here. I think if I step back, I mean, I wasn't signed up for this when I came to the track. I think if I step back and stop doing it now, there might be a knock on the announcer's booth and say, hey, what's going on? But, you know, Mark Patterson is he's the assistant racing secretary and he does the TV show. And I think that we kind of feed off each other a little bit, have a bit of a joke now and then. And it's we're quite comfortable. I think that he's the equal of any analyst in the country, the way he does it. He does it a little bit different to anywhere else in so far as trying to give a positive and a negative about every horse. He just does a fine job. I don't know. The knowledge that he has just swimming around in his head, I've got no idea how he can do that. He's a freak, absolute freak. So, yeah, we make a good team and, you know, we both promote the track as much as we can. And for right now, it's working well. We're doing what we can to keep the name out there, to keep Mountaineer's name out there. Mark Patterson coined the phrase Mountaineer Nation, and we've got such a committed following. We are kind of like a cult track, I guess, but we really do have a committed following, and they'll let you know if there's something that is troubling them. And Mark reads out texts online, and I respond to as many people as I can during the night by text. And you know, we're very open to responding as quickly as we can. Or if I'm asked something, I'll go to the stewards and try and get an answer as quickly as I can. That's very important, I think. And I would say that I don't know of any other track that does it better than Mountaineer as far as that goes. But there may be others equal, but I don't know of anybody that does it, you know, as well as we do it.
And it has that, you know, the Mountaineer Nation, it has that community feel.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. That's what I was reaching for. You beat me to it. Yep, exactly.
You know, I'll take the feed directly from the track sometimes rather than through TVG. And it just reminds me of a good old-fashioned racetrack where everybody knows each other and they're working together and, there's some pride in what's going on, you know, and even horses racing at the bottom, you know, they're getting the same kind of respect that a horse that's running in the feature for that night. As a horseman, I appreciate that.
Yes, and the community aspect. I think I don't hear much backstabbing going on as I have at other tracks, and everybody is working together and takes care of each other. I know that happens at all the tracks, but I think that considering that we're, you know, a lower level track, I believe our base of supporters is quite strong. And again, I think it's just the things we do a little bit differently as far as what we put out there, the way we do it. I would say that Mark and I don't have an off switch, really. And that Mark wouldn't be no good. He's not on social media. He would last an hour on social media. He'd be banned and go into Facebook jail or whatever they say. And when I'm calling the races, I'm not consciously calling them. I just go into like some sort of a trance or something, and you know, because I might swallow a moth or do that, and you've got to keep calling. And
you've swallowed the moth already.
I swallowed three moths so far. And in the early days, I got hit in the head by a pigeon, and in my first year there, a bat hit me, that was scary because I didn't know what it was at the time. And but then I realized about an hour or so later what it was, because there was another one flying around in front of me. But I haven't swallowed them off this year. I didn't swallow one last year, but the year before was the big one that I could actually feel going down my throat, like still alive. And you know, I kept calling the race. What? As best I could.
If anybody can handle it, I'm sure you can, because I heard a race that you called years ago, the Mountaineer Marathon, where a horse won by 45, 50 lengths? And when you say you're in a trance and not calling the race, you were having so much fun with that.
Yeah, but I don't remember a lot about it. All I remember is that I don't watch back any of my replays, because it's like, just, you know, it's done. I don't need to. I'd be too picky about the call. But with that one, I remember that I said the horse had won by 50 lengths. Theodore was the horse, and they gave the official margin as 49 3/4 lengths. And
so that's a pretty good eye, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, I had to say something, and I knew it was more than 40 and less than 60. But if, you know, in retrospect, I actually should have said 49 3/4, not because, it's 49 3/4, just because it's more interesting to say that than 50. Like, if I say 50, but he's just having a guess, you know, whatever. But if I can be specific, so after that, and I did demand a recount to see that it was 49 3/4 and not 50. But after that, you know, I'd be throwing out at the end of a race a horse had won by 11 1/4 or, 12 3/4, something like that. And I was able to nail it a few times, and then I just thought, I'll give up on that. It's like trying to call a dead heat. I've said a few times that, you know, dead heat, I can't pick it. And I've probably done that maybe twice a year, I guess. And I still haven't nailed one. I did call. I said that a finish earlier this year was a triple dead heat, and it was actually a nose by a dead heat. So I was only a nose away from nailing the triple dead heat. But that was kind of fun. You know, it's not going to be a triple dead heat when they hit the line, but you can't tell, so you just say triple dead heat.
I know in my like first. It sounds like when you're calling these races, you have a game within the game going on in your mind.
No, yeah, it's there are levels. So I'm calling. So I'm speaking, but I don't always know what I'm saying. I'm looking.
My kids tell me that
all
the time.
I'm thinking about what I'm going to say next while I'm saying something else. So I'm going down a level or going ahead and then going back to finish what I was doing, already knowing what's going on and what I'll have to say next. I might have seen a horse drop back quickly, but I've already gone through the field. So then when I go back, I know that I have to reference that so people don't think I've missed it. Like, oh, I saw it. Just let me get to this first, and then I'll address that. But, yeah, there are certain levels. I mean, sometimes I can do that and actually go another level in front. So calling the race on three levels, like, okay, I'm saying this. Now that one's done. I can switch that off. I can cross that off and go to this one. It's hard to explain, but it's just automatic. And, you know, I don't know what I'm saying half the time. I guess I've been lucky that I haven't said anything that would embarrass Mountaineer, at least not as far as I know anyway. But so I think that's probably instilled in me. I know what to say and what not to say. But so far, so good. You know, I need that one more year after this year to complete 20 years. And I've always said that I'd like to be the first person to call a race when I'm 100. So that's my goal. I mean,
you've got quite a bit of time yet.
Yeah, I've got plenty of time. But I'd like to keep calling until I'm 100.
How did you start announcing?
Well, I was 14. We have race calling schools in Australia. I'm from Melbourne, and in Melbourne there were two horse race, announcing schools for horse racing. And so I went there when I was 14. Used to go do it after school, and that's what I wanted to do. And so I was calling some trials here and there. But when I was 17, I got offered a job with Australia's leading newspaper at that time, anyway, The Age in Melbourne. And I thought, well, this is too good an offer. So I went to the newspaper, and I was there for a bit over 14 years, gave up race calling. And so I was a racing and sports writer at the newspaper. And then they wanted a correspondent for the US. So I came over here, and my wife was from Los Angeles anyway. So we came over here, and I was a US sports correspondent for The Age in Melbourne and a couple of radio stations back there. And then eventually, you know, I had a lot of time on my hand. I'd finished up working for Figs Form in Long Beach, and then the Racing Times in Gardena, and then Daily Racing Form. I was a news editor at the Racing Form in Phoenix. We started in Los Angeles, but then we moved to Phoenix after the Rodney King riots. And when the Racing Form decided to leave Phoenix and centralize the operation in New York, I said, well, you can let me off here. I don't really want to go to New York. And so Luke Kreitboss, who was calling it Turf Paradise at that time, said, look, there's a and I'd gotten to know him. He said, they're looking for a race caller at Arapahoe in Colorado. And so I sent them a tape of me calling some races at Turf Paradise, just into the recorder, not I have called a race or two at Turf Paradise, but not, that's not what I sent them. And anyway, so I got that job and was there for 2 years. And then in the second year, I also did Sunray Park. And then I got the job at Mountaineer. But what was funny is when Jim Dolan handed in his resignation, he said that he was giving them 12 months advance, but they didn't know that. They thought he was leaving in a few weeks. So they advertised the job and got all the people in for to audition. And then poor Jim wanted to stay another year, but the wheels had already been set in motion. I wasn't actually their first pick. Bill Downs was the number one pick. He was calling a lot closer to here anyway. But he turned it down, and so I finished up getting that. So, and here I am still. I don't live.
We're glad that you're here.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to let you go in a couple of minutes. Now, are there any little berries running around? Do you have any kids?
Yeah, there's. I've got. I have one. What happened with my wife? We were married for I don't know how long, but anyway, we got divorced. And then we got back together again. There was a gap of about 6 or 7 years. I kind of went walkabout, whatever. And so then we got back together again, got remarried. And, my son just turned, our son just turned 13 a couple of weeks ago. I took him, I wanted to make something special. I took him to Washington, D.C. to see a band called Roxy Music.
Wait a second. You took him to see Roxy Music, but it wasn't because you like Roxy Music.
Oh, well, you know, I had seen them about 20 times, starting in about 1975, but yeah, I think he needed to see them one time, you know, while I was still alive and kicking. Absolutely. So he had a lot of fun there, yeah. So, yeah, I've got a 13-year-old. So I started rather late in life, but better late than never. He's been a joy and a blessing, and all the words people trot out to describe their kids, yeah. No problems so far.
Good. Well, I'm sure you guys are doing a real good job with them. And
yeah.
I'm going to let you go, Peter. It was a pleasure having you on the air. I hope we can get you back on again.
Hey, anytime.
Because I think you can. Cool. You have so much insight.
Now, you know, I could be making it all up.
Well, that's what I thought.
No, everything I've said is true. On the first one, you get the truth. And then the next one, you get a bit of Australian embellishing, but not on the first one.
And by the fourth one, we've got to fact check immediately, right?
Yes, exactly. You've got it. Yep, no worries.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I've been a fan for a long time, and continued success and good luck with everything. And, you know, if you're down here in Florida, we'll get together. If not, we'll go in and get you back on the air.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you so much for having me on.
My pleasure. And we're going to take a brief break here, and Anna Ford from my favorite horse adoption agency will be on with us. She's from New Vocations.
The finest care for your horses in a quite relaxed natural environment. That's what you will get at Bally Rose Farm in South Florida. Customized feed, therapy, and turnout programs ensure that every horse gets the attention they need and deserve. With more than 35 years of professional experience, the Bally Rose team works hard for you and your horses, and is known for its client communications. Turnouts, breeding stock or layup, Ballyrose is your best choice. Visit ballyrose.com or call 561-774-5200.
And now back to the show. Here's Les.
And we're back. And we're back with Anna Ford from New Vocations. Anna, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I have to tell you, I'm excited to have you on the air because we've adopted three horses from New Vocations over the last 5 years or so. And one is better than the other. And we're very, very thankful and very impressed with the folks at New Vocations.
Well, thank you. Well, we appreciate great adopters like you, for sure.
No, it's been a great experience. And we've adopted from your Pennsylvania group, your Louisiana group, and Kentucky. And the one thing that I really want to bring out in our conversation is that when you are adopting a horse, and especially one that you know is going to be part of your family, you want accurate information from the people you're getting the horse from. And we found that by far above everybody else, the information that we get on from the New Vocation horses is just so darn accurate. And I think that's so important.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's definitely something that our whole team strives for. You know, we get a lot more information now than we used to on the horses before they come. A lot of that is just, you know, once x-rays and ultrasounds and all that kind of stuff went digital, it made it a lot easier to obtain things. But, you know, at the end of the day, we want to make sure that the horse gets the best home and that it's suitable for the person adopting it. And so, I feel like the more information we can give, the better. So it's always been our policy is to make sure we, you know, have full disclosure so that, you know, obviously we take horses back if they need to come back, but our goal is that they stay, you know, in their new home.
Tell us how the organization got started, because it's kind of an interesting genesis.
Mm-hmm. It is. Well, we're actually celebrating our 30th year this year. The program was started in 1992 by Dot Morgan, who's my mom. And we started at my parents' farm in Laura, Ohio, just a little town just north of Dayton. And the concept came up because there really was no other programs at the time adopting out retired racehorses, thoroughbreds or standardbreds. There was the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, which would take in the horses and retire them into fields, but there was nobody rehabbing and retraining and rehoming the horses. And so the concept came when Dot realized that there was thoroughbreds, specifically thoroughbreds, when they were done racing, being given away. And being given away, some of them weren't going into the best of places. Some were going into the slaughter pipeline, which was legal back then in the States. And so she was pretty horrified to learn that and knowing, yeah, the horsemen, how athletic and quality these horses were. And she was a 4-H advisor at the time and had a lot of students that couldn't afford a fancy horse, but definitely could handle and take care of a nice horse. So that's where the concept came, is like, you know, if we could be the middleman for the horses leaving the track and make sure that they're transitioned and get into the right hands, you know, they wouldn't have to fall into the slaughter market, basically.
And you operated out of Ohio until how long ago?
So we still have a facility in Ohio. We basically grew. So in 92, it was just the one facility. In 2001, we actually opened a second facility in Ohio. And then it wasn't until 2009 that we opened up a facility here in Lexington, which is where our base is now. And then from there, we opened facilities in Pennsylvania, New York, Louisiana. And then just in November, we opened our Florida facility.
And about how many horses do you handle over the course of a year?
We'll handle anywhere from 400 to 550, depending on, depending on the year. I know COVID year, we actually hit 600 just because the horses were flying off the shelves, basically. But this year we're looking at probably closer to that 500 mark.
one of the things that makes it so attractive, other than all the information that you give, is the pricing on these horses.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're affordable. But you, the cost of you keeping going has to be far more than what the adopter is paying. So how do you keep going?
Yeah, so one of our philosophies is that we feel like we want to keep our adoption fees affordable for several reasons. First, the majority of the horses that we have when they're adopted, they're still green horses, you know, and so we would rather someone adopt a horse for $2,000, $3,500 is our highest amount, and invest, like that's going to be the cheapest part of them adopting the horse, right? So we'd rather them invest more of the more money into the horse and the training than put a large price tag on them. We've also found that if we can keep the adoption fees affordable, that the horses are adopted quicker. And with, you know, it ends up being a numbers game at the end of the day. We want to be able to help as many horses as possible. And so if we can keep stalls opening up on a regular basis, then we can continue to take in new horses. So we'd rather put a lower fee on and have the horse stay with us for a month or two versus put a high fee on it and then wait 6 months for the right person to come along and spend that. So that's really been, you know, the way that we look at it. And it's hard because sometimes people look at some of the lower fees and think, oh, there's something majorly wrong with the horse. But in reality, you know, we'll disclose whatever there is. But we want to make it affordable for people. On the financial side of things, you know, we do a lot of fundraising. Some of these horses come in with a donation when they're donated to us. So there is some funding there that comes with the horse. So when you combine that with the adoption fee or with a grant, some of the grants that we have, you know, that's how we end up covering our costs. But, you know, in our business plan, we don't feel like the horses their fee has to pay for all their expenses that we've incurred. Because if that were the case,
it would be happening.
You know, a lot more expensive. Yeah.
As I mentioned, we've taken three, and all of them have come in exceptionally good flesh. You know, their teeth were done, their feet are done. It's just really a really comfortable adoption process. We have one now. That my wife got from the Louisiana branch, and he is probably the coolest 3-year-old that I've ever seen. And
what was his registered name?
Recalling Legacy. He's a Silver Fist. The reason he's so cool is he came to us and they said, your people said, well, you know, he's got some, some significant problems. You know, he had his cyst on his coffin bone. He's got a splint, you know, blah, blah, blah. But he's the easiest horse and nicest horse to work with. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly him. You know, with your people, we figured out how to shoe him for the first 4 or 5 months to make sure everything was going to be okay. And this guy is amazing. He's a character, but he'll cart you around. He doesn't turn a hit. I mean, he's just the perfect horse. And he was precisely what your people said he was. And that's great.
Oh, that's
great.
Yeah.
You know, and, no, we'll probably dip in and get another one before the end of the year.
Let us know, because we love adopters that, well, first of all, you guys are very experienced and you're horsemen. But, you know, a horse like Restoring Legacy, you know, had some issues. A lot of the equestrian world, just as soon as they hear, you know, cyst or fracture, tendon, anything like that, they're just like, oh no, I don't want that, and they move on to the next horse. And it's amazing how so many people miss out on really good horses that will be, you know, perfectly suitable for what they want to do. Maybe they're not going to be an Olympic horse, but they're perfectly suitable for what they want to do. But because they don't understand, you know, some of the common things that we see with the racehorses, that they just, they overlook them, you know, they're scared of it. So we appreciate adopters like you that are willing to have your vets, you know, consult with your vets and that you're familiar with things. And it's like, the other thing is sometimes the horses may have really bad x-rays or something, but they're sound and you're just like, you know, this is the x-ray, this is what's going on, but the horse has never been lame. And a lot of people will still pass that over, and that's hard. So we appreciate people like you all that'll, you know, listen to what our team's seen and done and experienced and be willing to take it on and give it a try.
Yeah. And the thing about it is, most of these horses that have gone through the races, they come with their personality and they are who they are. And so when you're adopting them, it's a pretty straightforward process. It's not like getting a horse that's totally green. And I agree with you about the vet thing. And that's a pet peeve of mine. You know, they'll see like an OCD in a 9-year-old horse and say, oh, that's something we can't live with. Well, for $800 or $1,000, you can live with that.
Right.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
So but these horses all need a home. They, you know, we get done with them when they're 4, 5, 6 years old. They still have another 20 years, and they fought hard. Even if they didn't make the races, they fought hard, and right. we've got to take care of them. You know, so
right,
we're 100% behind you guys, and anything we can do for you know that we're here to help you, and I appreciate you coming on, and I also apologize for kind of cutting you short a little bit, and we'd love to have you back on at another time.
Sure. Yeah, anytime. We appreciate you helping us spread the word and what we do on both sides, you know, for those that own racehorses that need a place to send them, and then maybe those that are, you know, equestrians that are looking for a horse. So we love what you're doing on your show and whatnot. So helping us spread the word really is extremely helpful. So we appreciate that.
Great, Anna. Thanks a lot, and we will talk to you soon.
Okay, sounds good. Have a good day.
You too. And this is Les Salzman. We're wrapping up this edition of the Thoroughbred Post, and we thank you for joining us.